This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-ik. Many parents have been alarmed that their children's screen time has soared during the pandemic, with things like online gaming and social media taking the place of other childhood experiences in lockdown. Of course, parents are concerned, are there irreversible effects on children when it comes to socialization, communication, and even the risk of addiction to online activities and devices? Can parents even do anything to dial back their children's device use? Joining me today to hopefully put some of these fears at ease, to put things into perspective for us, consultant clinical psychologist Dr. Nihara Kraus, all the way from UK, to help us figure out how to move forward. Hi, Dr. Nihara. How are you all the way in the UK?
I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for inviting me on your program.
Absolutely. So I think the last 2 years, regardless of which part of the globe you have been in, have been incredibly difficult for all of us. What have you been seeing among children in the UK? You know, if you could share what your experiences are.
Yeah, so I think that obviously there's been a huge increase in terms of digital use, unsurprisingly, because when we all went through various bits of lockdown, it was the only tool to be socially connected. It was also the main tool to be emotionally connected. So if you did want to reach out and speak with your grandparents, for example, or if you did want to perhaps release some of the kind of frustrations or deal with kind of getting some information for the anxiety you were feeling, then again, it was the only tool that could be used. And of course, we also know that it was the main tool for getting on with life. So whether that was shopping, whether it was ordering your medication, whether it was learning, working, relaxing, or indeed, in fact, even exercising. So what we have had is an enormous use and development of digital. And I think that's really important to think about, because we have really not just enhanced use, but the sophistication in which digital has advanced over this period of time is really huge.
That doesn't sound like it would be a bad thing. I mean, if it was really the only way that we could all reach out and stay connected to each other, it doesn't sound like it would be a bad thing.
Yes, it's true. And I think, as per all things, there's a very positive side to what's happened. But of course, it inevitably comes with a negative side. And I think we've got to start to look a little bit at human behavior and childhood interaction with such products to start to think about it. So firstly, I think if we talk about the positives, social connections are fundamental to humans. It enhances your mental health by about, it's one of the basic resilience and human needs. And social connections, so social media, for example, increased by 50% in 2020. And that was globally, not just in the UK. The negatives, however, is the worry that virtual might replace real life connections. And that depends on the age of the child. It depends on the social confidence of the child. And of course, there's also the opportunity to compare a lot more. So inevitably, again, as we go through childhood, learning and looking and developing a kind of comparison, we all know about FOMO, for example, but that opportunity is far greater. And of course, there's also great opportunity for people to bully online, and indeed even to sort of carry through with sort of sexual exploitation, which of course is a very concerning thing.
How is FOMO enhanced online, that fear of missing out, that need to be on par with your peers?
Yeah, so I think online provides us with an opportunity to compare in a major way. And it's also the comparisons there all the time. We know that people post the best bits of their life. They also post the most enhanced photographs of themselves. And so what young people are constantly seeing is the most ideal form of whatever somebody else's life might be. And so if that's what you're comparing yourself with, it's very easy to start to feel a sense of inadequacy or a concern, or indeed an increased sense of competition. which again, we know over the pandemic happened with regards to eating disorders. Mm. So eating disorders in the UK have triple fold. And that's partly because young people and adults started with thinking they'll use the opportunity to improve and enhance their bodies. But again, partly perhaps because of easy access to competition, communication, comparison, those kinds of conditions have not been managed so well. So we are dealing with a real difficult issue at the moment.
And if we try to look at it by understanding the psychology from a child's perspective, how a child's brain, how mature is it by this point, how developed it is, and, you know, try to understand then why some of these influences could have a more profound impact compared to adults. Although I think we can also argue that adults get caught up in the FOMO as well, don't we? But, you know, help us understand how developed are children's brains at different phases of their childhood, and why could certain influences be perhaps more damaging during those ages?
Yeah, so what we know about neural development in children is that it's a constant developing process. Our brain is constantly setting new connections, new cells, new regeneration, all the way through until the brain is about 25. So that's kind of relatively recent knowledge that we've acquired. And the greatest amount of connections start to be laid down all the way from about 12 to about 17, and that's connecting the front bit of your brain, which is called your executive functioning brain, to all the rest of it. So the executive functioning brain is a bit like the pilot of a plane. It's the bit that will start to look at the route ahead. It's this bit that will start to think about the speed at which the plane flies. It'll be the thing that starts to recognize what's dangerous, what's not, and how to manage and regulate that. So that element of being able to manage time, manage enjoyment, manage the impact of the emotions that are generated, possibly through whether it's games or through social media or through looking at content online, is really difficult for children. It's a process that's developing. And that's something that parents and carers need to be aware of and help them manage and regulate in some way. So the positives, what we know with young people is that the most common device still is the TV in terms of screens. And that goes back generations. So if you go and work with sort of the elderly population, there'll be a huge amount of TV watching too. So that hasn't changed. And that is kind of looked at in terms of entertainment in particular. But when you are young, visiting virtual worlds, creating imaginary friends, starting to develop an interest in social communication is part and parcel. And so children absolutely love that, creating your own characters, your avatars, being able to engage online and being as imaginative as you can. And of course, some of the things that are there have very strong learning components. You're learning about moral values, you're learning about how to interact considerately, you're learning how to take an empathetic view. But of course, you're also sometimes having consumer opportunities. How do you kind of work towards getting the next reward, the next pot of money that you might get? So that, depending on the age, can be a little bit difficult for certain young children to manage. I think when it comes to creativity, again, that's something that's amazing. The internet offers a world of opportunities, posting online, creating videos, watching videos, learning, all of those things are really positive. The biggest issue in childhood and adolescence is the amount of time that's spent. So when we look at interaction online, what we have to think about is the quality of interaction against the quantity of interaction and what effect that might happen, might create in your brain.
Mm. So if you're talking about especially the front part of the brain, that pilot that can do those really important things like regulate emotions, pretty much, you know, help you know what's right or wrong or know how to navigate situations. If that isn't yet fully developed at, say, the primary ages, would you think that kids shouldn't be exposed to this and be thrown into this vast field at that age?
I think children need to have support and help them to manage, because it's a learning process all the way through. And at the start, of course, parents help that regulation. Parents are the sort of pilots who help guide children. But ultimately, one of the biggest lessons we can help our children to learn is the ability to self-regulate, the ability to be able to say, oh, I notice that I'm getting really tired now. I notice that I'm quite agitated. I notice that actually I'm starting to feel quite anxious or tense, and be able then to hold back, to stop, to learn to recognize their own signs and to manage. So self-regulation is a very, very important skill. And that's something that we can help encourage our children to learn all the way through they're going. So I think it's not lack of access, it's educated access and how to use that in some way.
And parents have to do that, well, the moment they have kids, right? We're not just talking about when you give them the device, then you have to figure out how to teach them how to self-regulate. It would have been a process that should have started earlier.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think right from the start, it's recognizing that any digital device is a really powerful thing. We wouldn't, if you had a learner driver, we wouldn't give them some amazing sports car to drive. And it's the same sort of thing. We have to be we have to teach children to be respectful of the device that they're learning, that they have in their hands. And I probably are going to say something a little bit contentious here, but if you are a parent, don't give your child a device as a gift. And the reason for that is that we can't give a gift with conditions. We give a gift for someone to enjoy. So if you are going to give them a digital device, give it in a way that indicates to them that it's something to be responsible for, something that has some rules connected with it, and that there will be family rules. And it's very easy for parents to model some of those rules. For example, we don't have devices around the dinner table. We have breaks from devices at certain time and night. You know, we all put our devices away. So I think there are things that parents can start to model and help encourage right from the start.
All right. That's a brilliant, brilliant tip. You know, don't give it as a gift so that you can then, you're not setting up a precedent where you can't set limits to the use of that. We'll come back from this break to look more at, you know, if we're talking about quantity versus quality, what exactly children are doing and exposed to. Online gaming is a big concern for parents as well. Let's come back and discuss more of that with Dr. Nehara Krause, consultant clinical psychologist from the UK. She's currently working in her own practice, but previously was with the NHS. So I think she's got some insights she can share with us when it comes to children's use of devices, as well as social media and online sites, which has soared during this pandemic. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shao-Ik, and my guest, consultant clinical psychologist, Dr. Nehara Krause from the UK, where she currently has her own practice, but she has spent many years with the NHS, and she's sharing her insights today when it comes to children's use of devices, gadgets, and as well as being online, basically just being hugely exposed to the digital world, especially in the past 2 years. What might be some risks that parents should look out for, and how parents can help guide their children? Now, Dr. Nehara, earlier, and I want to pick up on this, you talked about the positives of what children can do online, where, you know, they can explore so much creativity. They can create imaginary characters and worlds. There's social connections. I'm wondering whether there are pitfalls there where, and you said this yourself, right? Is it a case of virtual replacing real life? Why couldn't we have had children build imaginary stories with toys as opposed to being online, where I guess, you know, they don't fall into the trap of thinking that everything that happens online is replicated in reality.
Yes, I think that's an extremely good point, that what we need to be able to offer children is a range of experiences. So they need to be able in real life to be able to learn to communicate. They need to be able to know how to engage online. So it's not just as easy as following somebody. You need to have those initial socializing skills. Similarly, they also need to learn how to deal with conflict. So if you're online, you can just exit. You can stop following somebody. Real life isn't as easy. So they need to be able to learn some of those skills of engagement, of disengagement, of conflict resolution, of how to be kind, how to be empathetic. And although some of that may well be possible in a virtual world, we also need to be able to translate that into a real world. So there's the tool at which young people engage with. And earlier on, we were also talking a little bit about brain development. And one of the other things we know about the way our brain works is that our brain learns partly through engaging and through almost a sort of repeated quality. So if something is repeated over and over again, we develop pathways of learning. And some of those pathways, if they're engaged with enjoyment, you learn much quicker. So we all know we learn quicker through enjoyment than through fear. Mm. So some of that is recreated through chemical pathways called dopamine pathways. And dopamine in itself is very involved in the whole addiction cycle. So if you have got something that you're repeatedly engaging in, that's really high intensity, that's generating a huge amount of adrenaline, of excitement, you may well have a repeated pattern where you want more and more and more of that. So that's also something that we need to be aware of. So there's the tool and what young people are engaging with. And then there's also the qualities of individuals. It's really important for us to also know that not everybody who plays games gets into some sort of gaming dependency or addiction. Mm. So there's also the individual quality of a person. If you do have a child or young person who's very impulsive, who has perhaps got something like ADHD, which makes it very hard for them to have that stop button that's necessary. If there is a child who doesn't have a lot of activity levels, because again, if you're in front of a screen, then you're not going out, you're not playing as much. If you have a child who's very socially anxious, who has difficulties in social communication, if they're a bit obsessive, if there's a history of addiction in the family, then those would be the children you've got to protect even more, because they're the children who'll find the virtual world much easier because they don't have to face the real life consequences that come with engagement.
Mm. And when you say protect even more, then what is it? Is it regulated use, or is it perhaps restricting them until they've sort of cleared a certain phase?
I think it's about being able to provide them with more confidence to negotiate real life experiences. And this is true of any kind of parenting, is that if you need to be able to say, okay, this is your virtual playtime, but let's find opportunities for real life playtime. And if they don't want to do that, then you need to try and find out why. Is it because they're shy? Is it because they don't feel that they can be part of a group? What would they be helped with in getting on with things? So provide them with tools, help them to start to develop a sense of confidence about what they can do. How can they start to think positively about themselves? Can they engage in things that are out of their comfort zone? So not necessarily academic, it could be all sorts of other things that they might be good at. Mm. And how might they be able to do that? So you want to provide them with a balance of real versus virtual. And if you do have a child who has problems, some of those more vulnerable children, then you have to keep a bit more of an eye on them. And it might be that you have to make friends with them online. You have to see what sites they're visiting. It will be, you know, it's about being able to have very clear boundaries. Maybe sometimes even having a sort of Wi-Fi off rule at a certain time, which sometimes if you have siblings might not seem fair, but it's the whole family engaging in helping a young person to set their own limits.
And it's a conversation that every family has to have in their individual circumstances. you can't have one approach in a family fit another family, right?
Yes, exactly. So no one size fits all. So you need to know your family. You need to know your child or young person. You need to know how the whole family system operates. So if you have, if you're a working parent, for example, and you can't have oversight of how much time your young person has access to, then again, you have to think about that. What's realistic within that? Do you have to then really be clear that the other caretaker, whoever that might be, is in line with the same family beliefs, because otherwise you'll have a difference. If you're separated parents, then again, it's very difficult to co-parent and have different beliefs. So you have to work with what works for your family and ultimately look out for any warning signs, any negative signs of whether that management is impacting on your child or young person.
What might be some warning signs?
I think some of those will start off with sort of some of the physical things. So, for example, you might have a child or young person with sleep problems. Now, those sleep problems might not be necessarily related to screen use, but it's very easy for screen use to sort of try and change your night-day cycles a little. So have a think about that. If they're having sleep problems, if they are becoming more isolated from friends, if they are presenting with more headaches, there's quite a lot of nice research that looks at the connection between excess screen time and visual eyesight-based problems. So keep a look on that. Are they having lots of neck pain, for example? And then some of the behaviors. So if some of the behaviors they are engaging with, some of the things they're saying mimic what the game they might be playing online, then again, you might want to start to think a little bit about how that might be affecting them. The psychological studies that look at the impact between screen time and impact on mental health is very unclear at the moment. We need more psychological studies. There are some early signs that emerge to say that there's increased low body image issues. So people lose confidence a bit more when they've been online and they've done a lot of that FOMO comparing stuff that might go on. There are some reports of increased anxiety. There are some increased reports of low mood. The difficulty is that if you have got anxiety and low mood anyway, you're more likely to engage online in a different way. So chicken and egg slightly in terms of how they interact with each other, but we absolutely need more research to really show a kind of very clear connection.
And you talked about the relationship between dopamine in the brain and how that would induce somebody to seek more and need more to sort of feel good. And the addiction aspect is something that so many parents are worried about. Oh, my child is spending X number of hours online. Is he or she addicted? Is there a way for us to gauge when does sort of a normal use become addiction?
Yes, it's a really good question. So what we're talking about in terms of smartphone dependency or overuse or addiction is what in psychological terms is called a behavioral addiction. So there might be a chemical addiction going on with regards to the whole dopamine cycle, but certainly you can have a behavioral addiction. So for example, you might have sex addiction, which is a behavioral addiction. So there are certain types of behaviors that we become dependent on. So the way to notice that would be, again, firstly, if you have got somebody who gets incredibly agitated when they can't have access to their phone, but in a very, very enhanced way. So they're irritable, their behaviors are out of control, they can't self-soothe, they're pacing up and down, they kind of become incredibly violent even or demanding in terms of needing the kind of soothing element of that phone. So that's one of the things that you might want to look for. And then in a similar way to an addiction, you would have more and more increased use of that particular device in order to get the satisfaction that you get. And this is really difficult because if you're a gamer, for example, you're encouraged for more and more use. You know, you can't get to the next level unless you play. So it's very difficult for young people to leave when they're just about to win something to do that, but also something like the videos that we watch or the film entertainment. You know, you finish one episode and then you've got the next episode coming in
the Netflix effect,
for example. Exactly. So, you know, it's very, very easy. And I think a lot of adults would say that over the pandemic, their boundaries completely collapsed. They were sort of watching 3, 4, 5 mm-hmm. episodes at a time, mm-hmm. thinking, I don't have to get up early to get on that train to get to work, so I can just watch something more. So it's very easy for us. Now, is that an addiction? No. But if you start to feel that actually you can't go without, you can't drop off to sleep without watching it, you can't connect without it, then that essential nature would indicate that something's troubling. And then similar to an addiction, if you give up on something, you'll go through withdrawal if you have got that dependency. So the withdrawal will be shown by a huge amount of agitation, behavioral difficulties. And if you're a parent trying to engage your young child from doing it, then be prepared for that. But again, try and find out what it is that they're worried about. Why are they using it? Are they using it because they feel that they'll miss out on their friendships, in which case you need to help them to develop opportunities elsewhere? Why else are they using it? Are they using it because they're really low in mood and it helps them to sort of feel a little better and in control of something, in which case their mood needs treated? So if you're also going to take away something that has become a reliance, provide them with an alternative that actually gets to the heart of the problem. And that's true of any addiction. If it's alcohol, if it's drug addiction, you can't take away the substance without finding out the reason for why that substance has an importance in that person's life. Mm. So it's an ongoing process of helping young people to manage a very powerful tool.
I mean, I can imagine perhaps an older teenager might be able to articulate some of those underlying concerns. Younger children, perhaps they might, the only thing they can come up with, perhaps it's fun. I love it. What do we interpret of that?
Yeah, so absolutely right that children don't always have the words and they will always focus on the positives often of what's happening. So I think as parents, we need to learn to understand our children in multiple different ways. So very young children, children in the sort of mid-childhood level will often present concerns physically. So things like stomach aches, headaches will often be kind of signs of potentially not feeling, you know, feeling anxious, feeling kind of sad. So they might have increased reports of pain, for example, which might be the way they express it. Behaviors are probably the most kind of common and frequent ways in which children express them. So if their behavior has changed and it's changed for the negative and it's changed quite drastically, either in terms of them being more withdrawn, more passive, more quiet, if their behavior has gone the other way and they're becoming very disruptive, constantly getting into fights, really irritable, or indeed if there are other harmful behaviors. So are they self-harming, for example? Are they have high-risk behaviors? Teenagers in particular resort to high-risk behaviors to try and get away from not feeling good. Then those are all indicators. They're all clues for parents to be able to kind of go, I need to spend some time trying to find out what my young person is communicating with me.
I want to spend a little time talking about bullying and potential violence or exploitation online, which is sort of a different dimension to what you might experience in offline situations, so to speak. How is the online world so much more dangerous for kids?
I think that there is kind of a lot less monitoring, isn't there? So it's very easy for children to either accidentally or intentionally stumble upon content that isn't appropriate for their age, is harmful in terms of, you know, there can be very explicit pictures, for example, online or content online. And of course, there's a lot of misinformation online as well. So that is the fact that there's no censorship in terms of what they access is something that parents need to be aware of. Also, I think that it's very easy to post things online because young people sometimes don't really know where their limits might be. And so to put something down there without thinking about the consequences of that. So again, a little tip I always say to young people is use the t-shirt rule. And the t-shirt rule is, would you put what you're putting down online on the front of your t-shirt? If you're going to wear what you put online on your t-shirt, then by all means put it, but otherwise don't put it down. But schools, certainly schools in the UK, are doing a huge amount in terms of education about how to engage in real life and how to engage online. What might be, what could you say? What shouldn't you say? Think about the impact of it. So stop, wait, think about before you post something. Mm. And then I think for young people, it's about being able to, again, recognize when something is harmful or when something is kind of unhelpful, and to also then really try and stop that from spreading. So if you have a class and somebody has posted something nasty, don't share it with the rest of the class. Don't share some sort of photograph that's been private with somebody else. So there's lots and lots of education, I think, that we need to do, and protection.
So, you know, I've been coming at this from the perspective of a parent, but, you know, you are talking and working directly with young people. And, you know, I hadn't thought about this. I'm sure young people themselves have their own thoughts about their own online activities. It's not all fun and games. Are you hearing from them that they are also concerned about how is all this playing out for them?
Absolutely. So young people are concerned. They're concerned. It depends a little bit on the age. So as you become older and as your relationships start to become more complicated, I think young people are becoming very concerned about extra use. And I think in a funny sort of way, and this is not necessarily something I've read online, but certainly what young people have said, is that having to be so much online over the pandemic has actually worked in a way to their advantage, because they appreciate real life connections a lot more. They appreciate going into school and learning sort of face to face. So actually a lot of them have said, I just slightly overdid it. I kind of went overboard. I now don't want to do all of that sort of screen time. I'd much rather see somebody and go for a walk with them or catch up with them rather than that. So that's really great that they appreciate that human contact more. But also, I think young people are becoming more conscious and aware of green issues, of the fact that, you know, digital usage is costing our environment, is having an effect. And young people are very, very conscious, again, in the UK in particular, about environmental issues. So there is a more of a movement to be more responsible about digital use. I think the hardest age group to manage are probably between 9, 10 and about 13, 14. And that's because a lot of interaction at that stage is all around finding where your position is in a peer group. It's about competition. It's about being the same as everybody else. And it's also when that frontal bit of your brain, the executive functioning bit of your brain, is yet to develop. So that's the group that actually a lot of work needs to be done with in terms of supporting and managing.
Mm. And when it comes, coming back again, I guess, to parents' concerns that whatever the kids have been sort of drastically exposed to in the last 2 years, and, you know, the fact that they seem to need more validation or pleasure or connection online now. I mean, I guess a lot of parents are just thinking, does this have irreversible effects, you know, or can we, if we start to get kids back out to school, meeting friends again, just hanging out together and all of the pre-pandemic kind of stuff, you know, will we be able to give them a normal childhood again?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So humans, human brain, the human brain, human behavior is very, very adaptable. And I think one of the things that we do have to start to do now as parents is to start to look at where did those boundaries all go out of sync? Because many families would say that there was a lot more screen time, bedtime all kind of got disrupted, eating routines all got disrupted. So how do we slowly start to dial back and reduce things? And that might be that we've got to kind of help with a more of a rule setting process. We need to start to open up our worlds to all of those opportunities that had to go on hold. So whether that's sort of new learning opportunities, whether that's around different ways to experience relaxing, catching up on fitness if he couldn't do that, all of those wonderful creative things that perhaps we couldn't do that went on hold. Can we start to do those again? And I think the pandemic really enhanced the appreciation of nature. So can we hold on to that? And can we encourage our children, young people, and as families to do things? Lots of families started playing games again. So it was like an extended Christmas for certain families. Can we keep those? Can we maintain those? So I would say to parents, absolutely, hold on to the positives that emerged from the pandemic in terms of family connection, in terms of enjoyment of new things, old-fashioned things maybe even sometimes. Start to cut back on some of the things that have gone out of sync, and really start to look forward in terms of being motivated and setting new goals on moving forward. And I also think a word of warning to all parents out there is that prior to the pandemic, mental health in particular was escalating in young people. And part of that was because there was so much pressure. There was so much competition to be the best of the best, to get the highest grades, to kind of get ahead of everybody else. Their social calendar was absolutely packed because parents themselves were anxious about them not having a kind of a relevant CV to get them into university, to get them into that kind of really good school. Mm-hmm. And I think being able to have what really has been a sort of international kind of social experiment almost that we could never have otherwise gone through. Let's use it positively to say maybe that pause has helped us to reevaluate what we want in life. You know, let's not be as focused on grades, as focused on getting ahead and being the best of the best. Mm. Let's think a little bit about those good old-fashioned values and help our children to not be so stressed, but still to kind of develop and get the best of themselves.
I mean, the other day, a young person told me that it was only during the pandemic that she realized that it's okay to feel what she feels, and that it's okay that sometimes she feels down and she just doesn't feel that she's doing all right. But that idea that our children and young people have a right to feel the emotions that they feel.
Absolutely. I think that we can emerge, you know, if you look at pandemics in the past, if you look at crises, wars, etc., people are enormously resilient, and resilience, the word resilience, emotional resilience, emerged from the war. And it's all about how do we learn from some terrible experience that we've gone through, and how do we use all of the different ways in which we've adapted around it to deal with that. So we have learned to be more empathetic. We have learned that the impact of the pandemic has been disproportionate amongst different communities, amongst different ages. There has been enormous amount of compassion. So you mentioned my clinical work, but actually I also founded a teenage mental health charity 10 years ago. And the amount of engagement and giving and empathy has been enormous. People have wanted to do things to help other people. So we have got that. We have got that care that has emerged from there. People have been able to recognize grief and to be able to express that. So you are absolutely right that we need to be able to connect with those emotional elements of ourselves. We need to be able to express them. We need to be able to deal with them, because ultimately they are the things that help us to be emotionally stronger as we move forward. And one thing I do need to say about the benefits of digital is that with rising mental ill health issues post-pandemic, and actually prior to the pandemic, and lack of access to resources. Resources are stretched. We cannot deal with what's emerging. There are some really good digital health tools around. So without being big-headed, I actually create digital health tech. I have four apps that are available for young people. They're used across the world. I have close to 3 million downloads on kind of the use of those apps. But I think there are some very, very good self-support measures that are available. So we can also seek digital to help boost our health, to help manage our health, and to deal with that effectively too.
What are some of these apps? I'm sure that they can be used by Malaysian kids as well.
Yes, of course. So a lot of people know about a number of the mindfulness and meditation apps that are around. And those apps will help just to kind of be in the moment. My apps, which are created for my charity STEM4, the first is actually to help young people manage their urge to self-harm. So it's kind of around managing impulse-based harmful behaviors, and that's called Calm Harm. The second one is to help manage anxiety. So it has some ways to kind of physically manage your anxiety, to challenge negative thoughts, to learn to sort of set yourself some healthy goals. One of them might be to have less digital use, but you're setting it yourself. And that's called Clear Fear. The third one was developed just before the pandemic, actually, which was for parents and carers on tips on managing a young person who has got a mental ill health issue. And the last one, which is the most recent one, is for low mood. But it's actually a really good app because it helps you to get your motivation back. Because for a lot of young people post pandemic, we've sort of lost our impetus to keep moving. I don't know whether you've noticed that in Malaysia, but certainly in the UK, you know, that sort of, we've sort of taken our foot off the pedal.
And the term languishing that came up.
Absolutely, the term languishing that came out as well. So if you are languishing, if you are feeling a little bit like, oh, I kind of need to get back on track and you can't, then you can use Move Mood, which is you have an avatar and it helps you, or a companion, and it helps you to sort of set a little goal for yourself and try and achieve that goal, and you can get a streak. And so it's sort of done in a gamified, fun way, mm-hmm. but actually you're helping yourself to kind of move forward.
That sounds fun and sounds like something adults would find useful as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. They actually follow sort of evidence-based therapy tools or practices, but it doesn't look like it's a kind of therapy approach. It just looks like a fun thing that you can do.
All right.
So they're all co-developed with young people. So I take a therapy approach and then I'll work with young people on saying, will you use this idea? Will you, what about the language? What about the images? So it's a really great way to sort of get something to work for young people, because it's their ideas too.
I've left the best question to the last. Is there a suitable amount of screen time for kids? Would it be X number of hours? How would parents navigate this?
Oh, it's so difficult, because if you look at the recommendations and the literature, it's so widely spread. So in around 2017, the World Health Organization said no screen time whatsoever for under twos, and 1 hour for 2 to 5 year olds, mm-hmm. and then no more than 2 hours for, and then that was all kind of challenged because actually there wasn't an evidence based for it. So the jury is out. I wish I could say to you, this amount of screen time is kind of the absolute best amount of screen time. If we look at some of the studies that's showing some sort of impact and concern, it seems to be round about four. If you have 4 to 5 hours and over of screen time, it definitely in a day, it does seem to be indicative of something that is too much. And I think if you're an adult, think about that, because you might go, oh, I don't kind of use that much. But actually, if you think about the times when you're, I don't know, at the bus stop and you have a look at your phone, or you'll have a look at your social media, and then you're kind of, it can very easily catch up. So I'm going back to my quality versus quantity. If you are interacting online and you're doing a lot of Zoom calls and you're doing a lot of reading online, then is that better than, you know, having an hour of a game? hard to say, think a little bit about, but I think that that would be something to do. Have breaks, try and do some of the kind of meetings that you have to have face to face. But I would probably say that you should definitely have a break from just the strain of looking at screens. I don't know, every hour, every 45 minutes, give yourself a 5-10 minute break to walk around, stretch, you know, just so that your eyes have some rest, your brain has some rest, because your brain gets tired too. We just don't notice it in the same way as our body gets tired.
Mm. I mean, I think also 4 to 5 hours a day, if kids are spending, let's say, more than half a day schooling and doing homework and things related to that, how much more of that time is left for them to really be doing all the other things that you talked about?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I think that if they can do some relaxed time around activities, then that would be much better. But yes, I think there needs to be some boundaries, shouldn't there? Because if they've got to come home and then do homework online, then that's a lot of screen time again to be able to sort of deal with. So yeah, a good, you know, game outside or a run in the park, or, you know, I think we do need to mix and match. And if you are a parent, just watch out again for the balance. There's lots of parents who are working through the night. You know, I think that again, I'm always sometimes surprised because I'll send a message thinking, oh, I'll send it in advance of tomorrow. And, you know, it could be midnight and I'll have a text back because somebody's awake. So watch your own screen time too, and think a little bit about having a break.
Yep. A final message, Dr. Nihara?
Final message, let's really use the benefits of screen time. I really, really want to emphasize that screen time has a real place in our lives in terms of social, educational, leisure, learning. Let's keep that in place, but let's also really try and be aware of the negatives of it and manage and monitor it and be aware of ourselves and how we might want to regulate the impact it has on us.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Nihara. I've been speaking to Dr. Nihara Krause, consultant clinical psychologist in the UK. We've been discussing children's use of devices, social media and other online activities, and how we can look at this positively. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.